Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Algeria, where Gaddafi's family have just taken refuge, and talk with Laurie Brand, Professor of International Relations at USC, who studies North Africa. We'll examine the regional implications of the fall of the Gaddafi dictatorship for the neighbouring states, in particular Algeria, where the ruling regime supported Gaddafi and are now being asked to turn over his family. Then we'll get an update on the big storm and its aftermath from Andrew Revkin, who is the creator of the New York Times .earth blog, where he covers global environmental issues and climate change. We will discuss Hurricane Irene and its possible relationship to climate change, as a growing number of serious weather events are occurring with increasing devastation, requiring more and more federal disaster assistance. Then finally, we will talk with Glenn Carl, a former CIA interrogator of a suspected high-level al-Qaeda member. His new book, The Interrogator and Education, tells a story, and we will also ask Glenn Carl about Dick Cheney's defense of torture in his new memoir and the CIA's censorship of FBI agent Ali Soufran's new book that accuses the agency of missing a chance to derail the 9/11 terrorist attack. Joining us now is Laurie Brand, who is the Robert Granford Wright Professor and Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern California. Laurie Brand specializes in North Africa and Middle East international relations and inter-Arab politics, and she is a past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. Her books include Citizens Abroad, Emigration and the State of in the Middle East and North Africa, and Women, the State and Political Liberalization, Middle Eastern and North African Experiences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Brand.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And apparently a convoy of Mercedes limousines, armored Mercedes, crossed the border into Algeria at the southwestern Libyan town of Hadamis into Algeria, and the Algerian foreign minister has made a public statement saying that Gaddafi's wife Safia, his sons Hannibal and Mohammed, and his daughter Aisha have entered their country and presumably are seeking asylum. Would this be an official case of asylum?
Well, it will be interesting to see exactly how the Algerians handle it from here on out. This whole issue of the unfolding revolt, the violence and so on in neighboring Libya has been, it's a very interesting case following Algerian foreign policy, and analysts in the Algerian press themselves are sort of perplexed by the way that the regime has handled all of this. They feel that the diplomacy has been poor or lacking, and that the Algeria's strategy of communicating what it's doing or just trying to figure out what Algeria is doing has really been quite a problem. So it leaves Algeria sort of isolated regionally. Initially, Gaddafi had charged the Algerians with supporting the rebels, and then, of course, the rebels charged Algeria of supporting Gaddafi, which appears to be more close to the case. Just the full extent of the support, we don't know. What this will mean now for the fact that Gaddafi's wife, two sons, and his daughter have taken refuge there, I think the Transitional National Council has already said that they expect that the Algerians will return them for trial in Libya at the point at which Libya actually requests that. So that hasn't happened yet, but for now the Algerians, I think, have a very very sensitive diplomatic situation on their hands.
So, Laurie Brand, what would explain then the Algerian position? Because certainly the rebels in Libya believe, and they've accused Algeria of providing Gaddafi with mercenaries to repress the revolt. My understanding is that that's pretty much been accepted by everybody in the neighborhood, that Algeria was on the side of Gaddafi, where everybody else wasn't, except for some African countries.
Right.
And Venezuela.
Well, I think we need to put it in the both the regional North African context as well as the larger context of what's been happening in the Arab world over the last 7 or 8 months. If you look at the Algerian reaction to the, you know, the unfolding revolt slash revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia, it was also kind of a deafening silence. They're also one of the few countries that hasn't taken a position critical of the Syrian regime and the current use of lethal force against its population. So it's quite clear, and you know, not surprisingly so in general, that all other things being equal, autocrats prefer other autocrats, and instability, particularly instability that might be leading to more to the establishment of political systems that might be more participatory, more democratic, is of concern. So in general, the Algerians' leadership would be concerned about that because, of course, Algeria is seemingly sort of stuck in its authoritarian military paradigm. Algeria, when I was there last March, talking to a number of people about, you know, why elsewhere, why not in Algeria, a number of Algerians said to me, well, we had our... we had our spring, we had our opportunity, our revolt in 88 and 89 when there were massive demonstrations. And actually, it was a massive change, a deep structural change in an important structural change in the political system, a move away from a one-party system to greater political pluralism. But then shortly thereafter, the country descended into this, what they call the dark decade, and whatever promise there was of real change was overturned. So in any event, it leaves the regime in Algeria one that is going to be highly sensitive, but in a very negative way, to these kinds of revolts and revolutions that may well bring more open political systems elsewhere in the region. In regional terms, there are other concerns that the Algerians have. One is that Gaddafi was a supporter of the Algerians, certainly in their ongoing contest or conflict with Morocco over the Western Sahara. So the Algerians are unhappy, certainly, to be losing a major supporter of theirs in the North African region for the Polisario's claim on the Western Sahara region. So that's an issue. It further empowers Morocco. And Morocco and Tunisia both have, basically from the early days, I think, of this Libyan revolt, extended feelers to the rebels and now have, put in place contacts. Tunisia's, I believe, has recognized the Transitional Council. Morocco recently sent a high-level delegation to Benghazi. So there are the other regional neighbors have already positioned themselves to establish good relations with whatever regime comes out of this revolt in Libya. So that's also of concern to the Algerians. And then the final thing I would say in terms of regional issues is simply the Algerian government's concern about stability in the Sahel region, in the Sahara, the degree to which Libya can, as one article that I was reading recently said, turn into sort of an open-air arms bazaar, particularly in the south, which would enable groups that would either the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or other groups that continue to carry out attacks against the Algerian state provide them with continuing support. So these are all considerations that the Algerian regime is currently contending with.
Again, I'm speaking with USC Professor of International Relations, Laurie Brand. Well, apparently the arms bazaar is happening in Agadez in Niger. It's one of the biggest open air, and it's all, most of it is the looted military equipment from Libya. But I would think that the Tunisian and Moroccan involvement is in part there to deal with that, and the Algerians won't be able to deal with it if they have such frosty relationships with this new government, and because some of these arms apparently are going into the Polisario battle with the Moroccans, and all over the Maghreb apparently, these are, you know, there's these camel caravans all over the place apparently. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, again, it's just, Morocco, or no, I'm sorry, not Morocco, Algeria traditionally had its diplomacy had a fairly good reputation. I mean, there are a number of high-level Algerians who historically have been important negotiators and mediators in other conflicts. And in this particular instance, Algeria was silent. It sort of hedged where it was even though it became increasingly apparent that it was supporting the Libyan regime. It never really came out and made its position clear. I mean, it did, and I think understandably so, it expressed its concern that this was initially an internal Libyan affair. It expressed its reservations about the involvement of NATO, and that's not a terribly surprising position given sort of Algeria's history and its colonial past and concerns perhaps about neocolonialism in the region. What is unusual about this position for Algeria is that in the past it positioned itself, both in terms of its diplomacy as well as, I would say, discursively, as a leader of revolutionary movements. I mean, Algeria defined itself by its revolution, this revolution which was remarkable by Third World standards, by any standards, in fact. And that it was a continuation of this revolution, this championing of causes against against repression and so on, which has been a mainstay of the self-definition of the Algerian regime, and that all seems to have been pushed aside or put on the back burner in this particular instance.
So, Laurie Brand, you were saying earlier that. The Algerians felt that they had their Arab Spring a long time ago, at the time when there was a popular uprising against the military government, but it was always characterized as the Islamic Salvation Front, the FIS, that were really leading that. You're saying that there were more secular elements, and the brutality that followed with this bloody civil war, which was where both sides just resorted to insane and barbaric violence has just numbed the entire country. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Well, what I would say is, in 1988, there were major demonstrations, and in some ways, not unlike what we saw not unlike what we've seen in other countries in these most recent Arab revolts. Primarily the young, primarily spurred on by economic demands, but also decades of single-party rule, so that there were some important similarities. The FIS came out of that period of single-party rule as the strongest contender, the strongest potential opponent to the FLN. But certainly there were lots of people, sort of civil society, secularists, and maybe not just even secularists, but also people who weren't part of the FIS, who were extremely active during that period. It's just that the FIS emerged as the primary organized opponent of the state, and then because of its successes electorally, it led or triggered then a military coup, in effect. Prevented a second round of elections, and then the establishment of junta, and then the country descended into what Algerians actually take exception to calling it a civil war. They reject that. They call it the dark decade, or simply the period of terrorism. But they really don't like to call it a civil war. But yeah, there clearly was violence, very ugly violence, ugly massacres, assassinations of various sorts that the country experienced throughout the 1990s. And so clearly, one of the reasons why we haven't seen Algerians mobilize in a way comparable to or similar to what we've seen in other countries over the last several months is precisely, I think, because of the memory of that dark decade. It's not the only reason, I think, but I think it is it's a very important part of it. People are not only still exhausted from that, but they are very wary of any kind of developments that might upset what still appears to be, at some point, a relatively dicey calm. I mean, there were just during Ramadan, we've had a number of instances. Some of them, Al-Qaeda has taken credit for. Others, which are attacks by people who, groups that are not announcing responsibility for them. But nonetheless, numerous attacks during Ramadan. There's been a very bloody Ramadan for the Algerians. And so, with that still below the surface, there's a real concern on the part of people about pushing the state, even though there is also clearly broad discontent across sectors with the Algerian state at this point.
So do you think, Laurie Brand, that Gaddafi will also show up in Algeria?
It's a guess. I really don't know. I think it's unlikely, but you know, I could well be proven wrong tomorrow morning. Giving asylum to family members, particularly female family members, is one thing. There's, you know, that's sort of more acceptable to offer Gaddafi asylum in the current regional atmosphere. I think would be extremely problematic for the Algerians. I would be very surprised, actually, if we found that. But you know, I could be wrong.
Well, it's interesting that you know, the example of when the FIS won the elections and then the government voided the elections, that's always been cited as the MO for Islamists. And as you know, Gaddafi used the specter of Islamists to justify his own rule. And people were very concerned and still are today about the Egyptian revolution, the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the notion is that, you know, one vote, you know, they want democracy.
One man, one vote, one time.
Yeah, one man, one vote, one time. Right. But you're saying that there was a much broader cross-section of other democratic and secular forces in Algeria at the time, and they just got swept aside.
Well, they weren't as well organized. They weren't as large. And see, the FIS had the advantage, just as the Muslim Brotherhood has had in some of these other cases. I mean, in another country now is the sort of the return of Nahda in Tunisia. One of the biggest challenges in Tunisia right now is precisely this terrible suspicion, if not reaching the point of paranoia, between the secularists on one side and the Islamists in the form of Nahda on the other side. So this is a common, I think, theme or a common manifestation that we find in a number of these countries, because in the case of the FIS in Algeria, they were able to operate through the mosques. There had been tacit, if not overt, encouragement of a sort of Arabo-Islamic trend as part of Shadli bin Jazid's strategy for reinforcing his rule in the 1980s. And part of what that did was open up greater possibilities, freedom for particularly unauthorized mosques that were established in Algeria. Mosques in Algeria became formally authorized and therefore fell under the control of the government. In other words, the government would provide imams for them only once they were completely finished. So a lot of mosques were left formally unfinished, and so they could have these imams who would come not through any sort of state training, but from other places. So they had their own minbars from which to organize, and so the mosque really became an organizing space in Algeria, not unlike what we've seen, you know, in some other countries, where it is the Islamists that end up emerging as the most potent opponents of the dictatorial regimes. But I think, you know, we've also seen the gradual taming or the gradual modifying of the programs of a number of Islamist groups. It's one thing to be in opposition, it's another thing to actually have to rule. And oftentimes when these groups are given the opportunity to rule, they demonstrate that they're just as inept and inefficient as other as secular or as non-Islamist parties have been.
Well, just in the last minute then, Laurie Brand, just to look at the regional changes now that Gaddafi's all but finished and his son was apparently killed on Saturday, Hamis, who led the elite military brigade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fairly likely that that Gaddafi's holed up in Sirte in his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, nobody knows. But his days are certainly numbered. And if you were mentioning earlier, the Moroccans and the Tunisians already establishing links with this new government. And this new government, through a spokesman, has already demanded to the Algerians that the Algerian authorities hand over Gaddafi's family to be tried in the Libyan courts. So already there's friction there between the new Libyan government and Algeria. So, what do you think of the sort of long term consequences here? If the Libyan regime is successful and there is they couldn't help but be a more democratic government, but a successful government there in Libya, how's that going to impact the neighborhood?
Well, I think the Algerian, and clearly you're absolutely right, there are tensions and there are resentments. I think that they are primarily directed at the Algerian government, not at the Algerian people, because I think in general the Algerian people have been very supportive of this Libyan revolt. So I think I saw someone interviewed recently who said as much. They understood that the government's position was quite different from that of the Algerian people. So that could help to ameliorate or serve as a basis for ameliorating relations in the future. A lot, I think, depends on how soon Gaddafi is found and what happens to him, how cooperative the Algerians are once the Libyans finally do make a formal demand, if in fact they do, and I assume they will, that these members of Gaddafi's family be turned over. If the Algerians cooperate in that, that could probably go a long way toward helping to soothe over relations. There's also the question of security cooperation, which the Algerians are going to be very keen on. In fact, one Algerian spokesman, although I think this is rather disingenuous, said that their recognition of the transitional National Council would depend first on the National Council's demonstration of its ability to crack down on Al-Qaeda, which is really kind of, you know, ridiculous. But clearly security cooperation is going to be a top concern of the Algerians as well. So I clearly, relations are bad now. They're strained, but I don't think that that what has happened means they're irreparably broken. A lot depends on how the Algerians respond now that it's clear that Gaddafi is finished, if they're able to sort of regroup and try and bounce back from what's been a fairly chaotic and in some ways hard to explain diplomacy.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Laurie Bragg. Again, I've been speaking with the USC Professor of International Relations, Laurie Brand, who is the Robert Granford Wright Professor, and she's also she specializes in North African, Middle East, International Relations, and Inter-Arab Politics, and she's the past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the big storm back east and its connection to climate change.